Good morning, everybody. My name is Suzanne Soldra, and welcome to Concurrent Session 1. We've got Andrew McKee presenting to us today on role of advisors within the financial services market, linchpin or leech. Andrew's presentation will last for about 30 minutes, and then I'll open it up for questions. We have a roving mic here that I'll be able to pass to people, so if you are asking questions, please state your name before stating the question. So just before I hand over to Andrew, Andrew McKee is a practising financial planner. About 18 months ago, he made the decision to leave corporate life and set up his own financial planning business. And he's actually working as an authorised representative for Australian Unity Financial Planning. Andrew has over 20 years' experience in the industry, with roles having been in, executive roles in financial planning, distribution, investments, and in risk. Recent roles have been Head of Life Risk at Zurich, where I first came into contact with Andrew, also Manager of Private Clients at Perpetual, and prior to that, various actuarial roles at MLC. He's really enjoying running a financial planning business and sees himself as a coach assisting his clients to achieve their financial goals. So please welcome Andrew.
Thanks very much. Thanks for coming along. As Susan's mentioned, I have a confession to make. I am a practicing financial advisor, so I have a slight conflict on this topic, you could say. For anyone who's read the paper, and I'm sure you've all read the paper because you've read every paper that you're coming to, you would know, so I'm not giving that much away, that I've probably come down in favour of linchpin a little bit more than leech. But it's a great chance writing this paper to justify my decision to leave corporate life and become a financial advisor. Firstly, I want to set the scene a little bit about the financial advice market. Sizing the market is pretty difficult. Even if you're trying to come up with the number of financial advisors, authorised representatives of licensees are not always financial advisors. They can be paraplanners, technical staff, BDMs. So even just trying to come up with the number of advisors is a bit rubbery. 15,000 tends to be the number that people strike. It gets a little bit more difficult when you try to look at the fees and commissions that advisors are taking. I made an estimate of $1 to $1.5 billion of recurring revenues, excluding upfront commissions or upfront statement of advice fees and excluding risk commissions. After the production of my paper, Rice Warner, hello Michael, Rice Warner conveniently released a paper for Industry Fund Services on the transformation of the financial planning industry, and they estimated that total advice fees and commissions of approximately $2.7 billion. Now, that includes $1.1 billion of risk commissions, so it's pretty consistent with my number. So I think we've got close to the right order of magnitude about the size of the market. And it's a sizable market, or, depending on your point of view, a sizeable burden for the end consumer. I also just wanted to touch in setting the scene on another important point for actuaries and more generally for product manufacturers, to understand that since FSRA, advisors are no longer product distributors, they're client advisors. And this is a pretty fundamental shift, and that evolution continues with the government's response to Ripple and the introduction of a fiduciary duty for advisors. However, every now and then I still hear people talk about advisors as agents of the product manufacturer. And it's just ingrained in some product manufacturers that advisors are agents. And I've got to tell you, the phrase really grates on me. We haven't been agents for a while. We're advisors of the clients, and the world has moved on. I also wanted to conduct a bit of an experiment, I guess, today, so a bit of audience participation, perhaps. The simple stuff first. Have we got anybody who is a financial advisor in the room? Good, thank you very much. How many people, show of hands, have been asked for advice by family members or friends? Yeah, all right. Not surprisingly. What about how many people have actually referred family or friends to a financial advisor? Substantially less number, not surprisingly. And one more sort of semi-controversial question. Who considers financial planners to be a profession? Oh, you got more than I was anticipating. My point of view is I actually don't consider financial planners at the moment to be a profession. The authorisation is via a licensee. It's not by a professional body. When I talk to my clients, I say I'm an actuary by profession, but my occupation is a financial advisor. So I don't necessarily think it's a profession. But then again, I don't think that lessens the skills that you need to develop to deliver professional advice for clients. So the experiment that I'm going to conduct is, if I can ask everyone to get on your feet, just making sure everyone's awake early on. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask five everyday run-of-the-mill financial advice questions, just to give you a sense of the spectrum that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. Now, actuary is a very intelligent lot, but you know, the actuarial skill set is different from the skill set that advisors need and different from the knowledge base that advisors need. So what I want you to do is, if you don't know the answer or you get the answer wrong to any of these questions, sit down. And I'm relying, obviously, on the inherent honesty of actuaries in this experiment. If you're all still standing up at the end, then I will revise my view of the inherent honesty of actuaries. What is the tax deductibility of initial advice fees and ongoing advice fees? Now, if you're thinking that initial advice fees are not tax deductible, but ongoing advice fees are tax deductible, then you can stay standing up. If you're thinking anything else, you can sit down. All right, we'll see how we go. All right, this one's going to involve a little bit of mass. A married couple, age 64, they haven't worked in the financial year. They have earned a reasonable amount of investment income. They've got plenty of assets outside of superannuation. How much can they contribute to super? So 64, haven't worked in the financial year. They have earned fair bit of investment income during the year. They've got substantial assets. How much as a couple can they contribute? Do your maths. Now, if you said $900,000, so you'd be getting pretty close. So that's the $450,000 in non-concessional contributions that they could both do each. By bringing forward, $150,000 a year, but they can bring forward 2 years. But if you included the $50,000 in concessional contributions that they could make because they don't have 10% their earnings, their employment earnings are less than 10% of their total earnings, then you would get up to $1 million that they could contribute. So if you said $1 million, or you think of $1 million, then you could stay standing up. Right, that didn't take long. That experiment was supposed to last a little bit longer. Nevertheless, well, I think that's a really interesting point, that $1 million, because people talk about, it's now difficult to get money into super, but if you've got money outside of super, you can get it in through non-concessional contributions. It's just concessional contributions are a bit more difficult. The other questions that I was going to ask was around indemnity definitions of indemnity definition and agreed value definition on an income protection policy. How income from an account-based pension is treated from the Centrelink age pension income test point of view. And how a death benefit would be taxed from a super fund or an account-based pension if it's paid to a child aged 30. All of those questions are regular run-of-the-mill questions or things that impact people. I didn't have to get down to the bottom of the list, which is a bit unfortunate, really. Just for that last question, by the way, death benefit paid to a child over the age of 18 would be a benefit paid to a non-tax dependent, and it would be the taxable component would be taxed at 16.5%, whether it's in super accumulation mode or account-based pension mode. People think account-based pension, that's fine, I'm never going to get taxed again once I'm over 60. Well, if you die and that money goes to a child over the age of 18, the taxable component will get taxed at 16.5%. All right, that was really just setting the scene a little bit. Thank you. I'm not going to ask you whether you think advisors are leeches or linchpins, but let me talk a little bit around the advice burden, the argument for a leech. At the moment, there's a reasonable proportion of people who are paying an advisor who haven't made an active choice to pay the advisor. In fact, many probably won't realise they're actually paying the advisor, and they're definitely not getting ongoing service. Many members of corporate superannuation schemes would fit into this category, where they're effectively paying for an advisor, not getting service, and probably unaware that they're paying an advisor. And these are the people who I think would be very sympathetic with the Compare the Pair campaign. Don't Say That Too Late at Night, Compare the Pair campaign, and could well consider the advisor a leech on their savings. Now, when I put this presentation together, I wasn't intending to have much of a debate around commissions and fees, but the government had other ideas, so I do want to just touch on that now that the government's response to Ripple has come out. With those new rules effectively banning commissions from July 2012, I think the commissions versus fees debate is no longer. Now, it will still apply to risk commissions, but I think you can look forward to that debate after 2012. Between now and 2012, there really is no longer a debate around commissions versus fees. It's all about transition to that new world. For individual advisors, there's going to be some pain as they transition their business models to a fee-for-service approach. For manufacturers, there's going to be increasing impetus, obviously, to produce products that operate under a pure fee-for-service environment. For the advice industry as a whole, it's got to improve our reputation, this move, which I think is a good thing. But the great commissions versus fees debate is dead, as far as I'm concerned, and there's no need to compare the pair anymore, and I won't be sorry to see those ads disappear. Either the client will get value from their advisor, or they'll stop paying them. It's as simple as that. They get value, they keep paying them. They're not getting value, they stop paying them. And from my perspective, that makes a lot of sense. So what do consumers who aren't using advice, what do they say, why aren't they using an advisor? Well, the FBA did some research through Galaxy Research and came up with these sort of reasons of why people aren't using an advisor. But I would also say some of those reasons are simpler. This is what people say. What are they really thinking? I reckon there's groups of people that either don't have the time to get advice, they don't think an advisor can offer any value, or they don't trust advisors. And look, there is a reasonable proportion of the Australian population who are born do-it-yourselfers, and they're never going to trust an advisor. And these are people who are not going to come into that advice market ever. And that's fine. They can keep doing what they're doing. And hopefully they educate themselves and make some of the right decisions. But moves to improve the general reputation of the advice industry will hopefully mean that those people who don't think advisors can add value or don't trust advisors, that proportion reduces and perhaps people can get a better outcome in their financial position. Warren Buffett said, price is what you pay, value is what you get. There is a bit of research around that shows the value that advisors can create. Recent reports from Rice Warner and KPMG Econtech for FBA and IFSA respectively. The Rice Warner research deals with 8 case studies of ongoing advice, does a net present value on those case studies to come up with the value that's created, and over those 8 case studies, over $1.7 million was created. The KPMG Econtech comes from a different angle. It actually looks at the average savings rates of people with an advisor and people without an advisor and comes up with about 2,500 extra savings per annum for people with an advisor. Now, people might be a little bit sceptical of reports produced for the FBA and IFSA, so I thought I'd actually run through a couple of real-life case studies as well about how, in this case, clients of mine have benefited from advice. Now, I should point out that not all of my clients are named after federal politicians, but it's nice to have a few of them anyway. Kevin and Julia. Kevin 60 is looking good for 60, really. Kevin 60, income 30,000. Some would say that might be what he's worth. Income 30,000, 100,000 in the bank, 600,000 in super. Julia 55, income 80,000, 80,000 in the bank, and 72,000 in super. By putting together some strategic advice around salary sacrificing for Julia, transition to retirement account-based pensions, moving that money that's in the bank, or the majority of that money that's in the bank, into super through non-concessional contributions, and making sure that Kevin can get the government's co-contribution, the annual benefits of that advice, $19,000 for those clients, versus what they were currently doing, which was they're in accumulation mode and they're just bubbling along, sort of not doing anything really strategically. So, 19,000. Another case study, again, sort of in that sort of approaching retirement category. Tony and Julie this time, on the opposite side. Tony 58, income 130,000, 200,000 in super. Julie 56, income 33,000, 60,000 in super. Similar approach, salary sacrifice for Tony to get that his marginal tax rate down, transition to retirement, account-based pensions, co-contribution for Julie, annual benefits of $13,000. Time and again, advisors around the country are helping people achieve these sort of results in their lead-up to retirement. And for these people, there's no question about the value of advice. I also wanted to briefly touch on insurance. Insurance is a really important part of providing advice to clients as well. The benefits of insurance are primarily around the pooling of risks, and as actuaries we have a good understanding of pooling of risks, hopefully we do. For individuals who make a claim on a life insurance policy, the benefits are pretty clear. They're making a claim, the benefits are pretty clear. For individuals who don't make a claim, and this is the majority of people, for individuals who don't make a claim, the benefit of life insurance is primarily the peace of mind that their wealth and the wealth of their family will be protected on their death, disability or serious illness. So it's a peace of mind purchase, insurance. And the value of that? Well, given policies are renewed each year, I think it's reasonable to assume that the value of that peace of mind is more than the cost of the insurance premiums. So there is real value in that peace of mind from an insurance point of view. What do consumers say? When asked by Galaxy Research about the key benefits of using an advisor, people refer to these sort of benefits. I think the really interesting thing about this list is the top two benefits there are intangible benefits: peace of mind and greater control. While it might be difficult to value these intangible benefits, we shouldn't underestimate them and how much clients value them, even though we can't value them. Part of the reason people pay for advisors is for peace of mind and greater control, so the benefits are valuable. One of my clients, after the first meeting, said to me, "I feel so much better." I hadn't actually done anything at that point. All I'd done was listen and take some notes. It's a problem shared is a problem halved, basically. I might have started to sketch out a little bit of a plan, but really, just sitting there listening, he left the meeting feeling more in control, or at least understanding that he would be more in control as we push down the path. So a lot of what an advisor does is built around these intangible benefits. Not to say that we're not delivering tangible benefits as well for many clients. So, what is value? Well, value is achieved when the expected benefits of advice outweigh the expected costs. So what really drives a consumer to talk to an advisor to start weighing up the potential value? Napoleon said, there are two levers to set a man in motion: fear and self-interest. Now, he's ahead of his time, Napoleon, because I think he's referring to the financial advice market. It absolutely applies here. Fear of getting it wrong and the potential impact on a person's financial position. These are the things that drive people to an advisor. I actually think the decision to seek advice is based on the following equation. And I think this applies whether you're 18, 55 or 80, whether you're in Australia, Argentina or Algeria. I think the logic flows along this way. Firstly, is there a choice to be made? And is that choice complex enough that you can make the wrong decision? Now, Australia has a very complex system. We have unbundled products. We have superannuation tax. We have company tax, trust tax, individual tax. We have investment decisions that people are making, choice of super fund that people are making, etc., etc. It is a complex system for people to navigate in the Australian market. And the difference between making an informed choice or making a poor choice, or indeed making no choice at all, can mean many thousands of dollars. So that first point is there a choice, and is the choice complex enough that you could get it wrong? That's the fear element, okay? Napoleon, fear. The secondly, is the choice material to your financial position? This is self-interest now. Now, if you're a subsistence farmer in a less developed economy, then chances are that any advice you receive is not going to be material to your position. Similarly, if you're an 18-year-old Australian, the chances are that you're not going to be particularly interested in getting advice about your retirement finances. And if you don't believe me, go and talk to an 18-year-old and ask them about their retirement finances. They are not interested. But when a choice becomes material, then that's when individuals start to think about getting advice to make sure they're making the right decision. Materiality will vary. It'll vary depending on an individual's perspective. What one person considers material, will be different from another person. Now, clearly materiality varies by age and life cycle, life stage, but it also varies by accumulated wealth, proximity to retirement, income, surplus, cash flow, the debt position, family circumstances, health, and probably a myriad of other things as well. They all have an impact on a person's subjective view of what is material and what isn't. For one person, you know, once their super balance gets to $100,000, that'll be material. For another person, when their super balance will have to get to $400,000 before it's material. So it varies based on individuals. We, this chart really is trying to demonstrate that. Insurance is more important for people with younger families and debt. Retirement finances, people really start to get interested in their retirement finances when they're about 5 years out from retirement. You know, we all know that it would be better for them to be more interested earlier, but the reality is it's not material to them earlier, it's material to them about 5 years out, and then people get very interested in how they're tracking towards their retirement. We do have an interesting fact that was touched on in the plenary session just earlier, that Australians can make choices about their super fund. However, the vast bulk of Australians don't make any choice. Most Australians are with their employer's default fund, in the fund's default investment option, and with the fund's default insurance cover. In September 2009, the Australian Institute of Super Trustees noted that more than 80% of super fund members were in a default investment option. In addition, the survey results released by the AIST show that less than 6.5% of super fund members changed their investment strategy within a three-year period to June 2009. So there is a level of inertia in Australian consumers when it comes to making active decisions about their super. And I really put that down to when it's material and when it's not material. So the number of financial advisors in Australia does point to the fact that when an individual's retirement is approaching, or when their super balance becomes material in their eyes, they do want the ability to make a choice, and they will talk to advisors and make a choice, or they'll decide themselves. So we have that choice, and I think people value the value being able to make a choice, notwithstanding that in most cases they're not actually making a choice. It would be a very, in the words of Sir Humphrey, it would be a very brave move for any government to limit or seek to control that choice now that we have it. I mean, super choice hasn't been in place that long, really. So choice in a market isn't a given, and there are plenty of countries that have less choice than Australia. But now that we've got it, I think it'd be tough to take it away from us. Just progressing the idea of choice and materiality a little bit further, choice and complexity. Demand for advice, I believe, is a function of the complexity in the system and the materiality for the individual. It's no surprise here in Australia that we've developed an advice market, given where, in terms of the complexity, the increasing complexity, we are on the far right. Australia has a very complex system. In addition, you know, we're a developed economy, there is a lot of wealth around, we've had compulsory super in place for a long time, so the materiality for individuals is also relatively high for Australia, relatively high for Australians. And what this is really saying is that in a less complex environment, you need to have the materiality needs to be a lot higher before you would actually want to see an advisor. So less complex, less ability to make a choice, you need to have a higher materiality before you see an advisor. In the Australian market, it's really saying materiality can be a fair bit lower before you will want to see an advisor, because the materiality of making that decision in a complex environment kicks in earlier. So it's not surprising we have developed a pretty substantial advice market here. In addition, the advice industry creates value for the broader economy and also helps the financial services market. Let me talk a bit about that. In October last year, a KPMG EconTech report for IFSA estimated that if an extra 5% of people received advice in Australia, it would boost GDP by 0.6% over 6 years. Now, 0.6% doesn't sound like a big number, but when you multiply 0.6% by GDP, which is quite a big number, you get 7.2 billion based on current GDP levels. In other words, the additional GDP per additional person taking up advice would be $8,000. So $8,000 for each additional person taking up advice added to GDP over 6 years, based on the KPMG EconTech work. Now, that's a pretty good argument for making one-off or upfront advice fees tax deductible, I think. If we can get more people in, it adds value. I also believe that advisors are playing a role in increasing the efficiency of capital markets and the competition of financial services. By allocating client funds to different investments, financial advisors are improving competition between institutions seeking capital. Collectively, advisors are seeking investments that broadly reflect the underlying risks and returns of those investments relative to other investments. They're playing a role in increasing competition for capital and therefore in the pricing of capital securities, not as individuals as such, but based on their collective decisions or recommendations to their clients. As an example, I'm sure that the proportion of advisors recommending term deposits since September, October last year, when term deposits started to lift and become pretty reasonable rates, I'm sure the proportion of advisors recommending term deposits has increased as the value of term deposits, the return that you can get on term deposits, has improved relative to other investments. So advisors are playing a role in allocating capital. There's a quote in the paper from Adam Smith. It's a little bit long, but bear with me. It is not by augmenting the capital of the country, but by rendering a greater part of that capital active and productive than would otherwise be so, that the most judicious operations of banking can increase the industry of the country. I think that applies to advisors in this case. As a collective group, they're helping to ensure that capital gets allocated where it's needed based on the price that institutions are prepared to pay to get that capital relative to competing users of capital. Now, I'm sure that there's an actuarial paper waiting to happen on that, and I'd like to throw that open to anybody who feels like doing that for the next financial services forum. In addition, I would say that financial advisors play a very active role in ensuring competition in the financial services market. To paraphrase Don Chip, keeping the bastards honest with their pricing and quality. So advisors, both in terms of platforms, investment products, insurance products, are playing a role to ensure that the end consumer is getting competitive products. Without advisors, there is the potential that marketing dollars would rule, and it'd be hard for new entrants to really gain any traction. With advisors, it all comes down to the price and the quality of the product, or it should come down to the price and the quality of the product. But at least collectively, again, you know, individuals might make odd choices, but collectively, advisors are helping that competition in financial services. I'd also argue that there are probable benefits to the broader economy arising from reducing the reliance on individuals on social security and protecting the wealth of individuals and families through insurance and estate planning. Again, haven't done a lot of work on either of those, and you know, if anybody wants to pick that up for the next financial services forum, that would be perfectly fine. So, a conclusion. Well, I think you could argue that advisors, where it's a bundled cost in the product and the client is getting no service, you know, that people could consider that to be a leech. I understand that, but I do think that argument is going to die in the water over the next 3 years. Advisors do add value for individual clients, both tangible and intangible, as well as improving the broader economy and the financial services market. Complexity and materiality will always, because of complexity and materiality, will always have a demand for advice. I don't envisage a time where an Australian government would start to remove complexity to such an extent that we wouldn't need advisors. When Costello brought out the simpler super rules back in their last term, seems like ages ago, you know, he did say that this should reduce the need for advisors, but in fact it absolutely didn't. If anything, it added more complexity into the system and meant that, again, people needed to seek advisors. seek advice. So I think with Ripple, Henry and Cooper, there's no sign that complexity is going away anytime soon. I think you're guaranteed that politicians will be political, and they will make decisions on super that is political, and you know they're not going to do something that's so radical that's going to get them voted out. And I think we've seen some of that with the government's response in terms of the Henry review, ignoring what Henry was saying with super and actually putting in place increased SG contributions because it was something that was more political for them. Now, I'm actually quite happy with that outcome as an advisor. If they'd really started tinkering around with it the way Henry did, it was going to cause mass confusion and also reduce people's confidence in super. So I think this is actually a more sensible path, but personally. But what it doesn't do is doesn't take complexity off the table. So advisors will continue to be required to help people navigate their way through that complexity. The recent rule changes and the impending rule changes with Cooper, I think probably only serve to strengthen the position of advisors. And I'm prepared to say that their advisors are a key component. I'm prepared to say linchpin of the financial services market, and they'll continue to add value to their clients and the broader economy going forward. So why is this important for actuaries? What's in it for me? If as actuaries we accept the position that advisors are an important component of an effective financial services marketplace, then I believe that actuaries should be playing an active role in encouraging and supporting advisors. Now, there are plenty of roles that actuaries play. So we are advocates as an institute. We are advocates as individual members. We are advocates in that marketplace, and we can help with policy decisions around the ongoing development of the advice industry and the affordability of advice. One of the big reasons why so many people don't make active decisions is because advice can be expensive. And, initial advice fees tax deductible would be one path to make it more affordable, but affordability is absolutely an issue in terms of the advice market. As manufacturers, actuaries can assist with the shift from commissions to fees. They can also think about ways, developing approaches for dealing with that high upfront cost of advice. How can we try and work out ways that more people can get advice and set themselves up? As risk specialists, they can help advisors and their licensees deal with investment risk, and the Institute's put out some work on stress testing, which is terrific. But there are also other risks, accumulation risks in people's portfolios, but also in their lives, mismatching risks around longevity, around inflation and purchasing power, liquidity risks. Actuaries can play an active role in helping develop tools and approaches that are easy enough and cost-effective enough for advisors and licensees to implement with their client base. In the community, actuaries can help support advisors, and there's also that potential that if you get comfortable referring people to an advisor, then you can avoid the potential liability that most people in the room are taking on by providing advice to family and friends. I think most of the hands went up on that one. So just be aware that you're all got a bit of potential liability hanging over your heads if you're doing that. Me, I have professional indemnity insurance to help me cope with that. You guys, in that instance, probably don't. Plus, I think we'll see an increasing number of actuaries realising that they have a set of skills, a set of financial skills, that means that they can have very fulfilling careers running their own businesses and using their skills to provide advice to individuals. So making the same move that I've made, I think over time we will see more actuaries moving down that path. So, on that note, I'm going to throw it open to questions. Right at the back, number one. Oh, here comes a microphone.
The whole reason that there's been such regulation on financial planners is that there has been some very rogue financial planners out there and some very bad advice given to a lot of individuals who have lost a lot of money.
isn't the main concern for the industry is the quality of advice that's gone out? And I've had the privilege of helping clients look at financial planning advice, and sometimes I think the information can be a bit skewed and a little bit incorrect. So if you're going to be a linchpin, how can quality come back into the industry?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think absolutely there have been problems in the industry. And there's probably a couple of different answers, because one path would be, look, we probably need to give more training to advisors and make sure that they, you know, to lift the bar. But then again, would training have stopped a storm financial? Probably not. So there's an element of training, but there is clearly an element of supervision. Now, supervision of advisors starts with the licensee, but the licensees also need supervision, because in Storm's case, it was the licensee that really was at the heart of that. So you do need a layer of supervision. And I'm actually of the view, while I might curse some of the stuff I've got to do from a compliance point of view, I actually ultimately of the view that that's a really positive thing, because if it raises the bar generally of advisors, then we won't get that negative PR. So I think absolutely we've got to have the right level of supervision. I think there should have been some warning bells on rogue licensees or rogue advisors earlier. I also think that by moving from commissions to fees, you do take away some of that element. I mean, it's unfortunate, but when you're dealing with money, you're guaranteed to get some people who are not straight. You know, you're just guaranteed. You're dealing with money, it's going to happen. But by shifting from commissions to fees, you're making it clearer to the client what they're paying for and how much they're paying. The other thing that they've done is you can't charge an asset-based fee if you're gearing a client up, and I think that's probably a good thing too. That's in direct response to Storm. So it's a multi-tiered thing. You know, it's training, supervision, and the move to commissions and fees. I think that all is heading down the right path, but it's going to take time. And I think the industry has actually been on this path for the best part of 10 or 15 years to improve quality. I think we've got more to go. I've got one there. Sorry, you'll be next.
Wayne Brazel. The question, what you put up there about an $8,000 benefit per person, isn't that largely from diverting money from tax coffers back to the individual, and is it really adding value to the economy? And given what we heard before about skill shortages, isn't there more value to the community as a whole to just simplify the whole superstructure and divert those skill sets in more productive endeavours?
Well, again, I think there's two answers to that. One is the KPMG Econtech report, which is the basis of that, the 0.6% increase in GDP, actually didn't factor in the individual benefits. It was economy-wide modelling about what happens with increasing savings rates in Australia and what the economic impact would be if more people had an advisor, they might save more, and therefore what would be the flow-on effect to investment markets and business capital, et cetera, et cetera, and how much money we would need to fund domestically versus getting in foreign capital. So that was the KPMG Econtech report. It's quite an interesting one. It's available from the IFSA website. And so that wasn't solely around that. All I did was take the 0.6% of GDP and divide it by 5% of Australians to get the 8,000. So nothing particularly sexy on that mass. I think that's an important point. In terms of simplifying the regime down and diverting the skills, it's always a possible direction that a government could take. I think it's incredibly difficult, though, for governments to give choice and then take it away. And that's effectively what you would have to do, I would think. If you're a government and you really want to simplify it to the point where people don't need advice, or where you're going to paternalistically look after people, look after their money, in a way, you know, Singapore has the Central Provident Fund. That is a more prescriptive environment than what we're dealing with here. I think it would be very difficult for an Australian government to introduce it, frankly, I just think, because they're politicians at heart and they want to get voted in, and I'm not sure that if you start taking away choice, you know, they would get voted in. But, you know, it might be sensible economically. I just don't think it's going to happen. Don't fight over it.
Thanks. Anthony Brown. Couple of questions. One is, how do you see the role of a licensee change in the new world? What shape would it take? What sort of services? And the other one is, if there's going to be more demand for advice and it's going to be more professional, where are all the advisors going to come from? Because we actually know that they're ageing as well. Where will the new ones come from, in your eyes?
It's a good question. How's my time? Okay, good. They're opening doors. I'm thinking, oh, my goodness. where are the advisors going to come from? I guess I'm saying I don't think there's going to be any less demand for advice. I'm not sure there's going to be, you know, a real flood of people to get advice. I think, you know, it's when people trip over that materiality sort of threshold that they'll start to seek advice. But I think we'll still have a lot of people who don't get advice and stay in default funds. And in a way, I actually don't mind that much. You know, it's when it becomes material that they should be thinking about getting advice. So I'm not sure that we're going to get a flood. I take your point about the ageing population of advisors and needing to replenish it. I think one is, you know, as the industry improves its reputation, you know, it will be more attractive to new entrants. But the other thing is just purely supply and demand. If there's demand for advice services, then we will have a supply, ultimately, because the price that they can pay, the price people are willing to pay, will drag advisors into the system. Most new advisors really go through the banking environments now. If you go back, you know, 30 years ago, new agents used to go through the life insurance companies. Now they tend to go through the banks and then they spit out of that. In terms of the question about licensees, I think that's a great question. We have a pretty odd structure. So to be an advisor, you have to be an authorised representative of an Australian Financial Service licensee. The licensee is responsible for the advice that I'm providing, but they do compliance on my files. Every now and then I go through a pre-vet process where I have to, you know, pre-send plans down there, but they don't they're not over my shoulder the whole time looking at what I'm doing. So they absolutely, they're responsible for it, but they're not actually looking at it on a day-to-day basis. It's an unusual sort of environment that responsibility actually rests with the licensee, not with the advisor. Now, clearly, if I deliver really bad or inappropriate advice, then A, my licensee is going to boot me out, and B, there is the potential that I could get sued as well. But the licensee is usually the one with the deeper pockets, and they're the ones that are responsible. Interestingly, I couldn't really operate without a licensee cost effectively. They provide power planning, research, technical support, whole advice infrastructure. So I need my licensee, absolutely. I wouldn't want to be doing it myself. To start off with, there'd be a lot of boring things I don't want to do. And secondly, it wouldn't be very cost effective. Does it change in a fee-for-service world? I think ultimately it does. I think we've got this dynamic where at the moment, licensees go and knock on manufacturers' doors to get, you know, sponsorships or bonus deals, or, you know, going to have a restricted recommended list, and to get on that recommended list you have to, you know, give us X dollars. I think that world ultimately starts to change, and it's probably starts to change now. It's not going to change immediately. But in order for the mechanic, I think it needs to take a bit of time, because what should happen is those manufacturers shouldn't have to actually pay that money, personally, which means their prices, the prices of those products should be cheaper, but then the amount that the advisors are charging probably need to be more, and the amount that the advisor has to pay their licensee probably should be more, because the licensees currently are making money. I mean, the only way a lot of licensees break even or make money is through the deals that they can negotiate with manufacturers. So something's a bit wrong in where the fees are getting allocated, and it probably will take a few years for that to rebalance, but I think it probably needs to. But again, the commissions versus fees path is the first step. That was a long answer, sorry.
Wayne Kennefec, thanks for your presentation, been very interesting. You had a slide about halfway through which was looking at the little pie charts.
Yeah,
which looked at the
Harvey balls.
Yeah, the Harvey balls. The need for advice at various stages.
Yeah.
Oop. And we'll get into that one. I've got a personal view and so interested in your thoughts on the view, and then perhaps what could be the solution. The person of view at the advice industry is very good at servicing that last column, the pre-retiree, and perhaps not very good at meeting the needs of the young families, the older families, and particularly the singles. My personal view is that that's a rational decision on the part of most advisors based upon their remuneration structures. And so I'm interested if you had any thoughts on what might be a solution to that, and why, how advisors could get more interested as a body of people in many insurance needs.
I think it's a good question. I think a lot of advisors are focused on the last column for a couple of reasons. One is the benefits that you can, the really tangible benefits that you can achieve for people in that category. And therefore they can afford to pay your fees. I think it's also got a function to do with age. If you're an older advisor, you're going to be tending to deal with clients that are in that older bracket. I have clients in their 30s and 40s, who I call sort of the mum and dad market, with some super but insurance needs with a mortgage. So there are people that have that need. I think you can, as an advisor, make money on those people. I don't think there's any reason not to talk to them. But again, that's probably an age thing. I'm in my early 40s. I like to say early, it's probably approaching mid-40s. So I'm seeing people around that age group, and, I do see those people. I think the singles, really young singles in their 20s, that is really difficult because they just don't have any headspace for it at all. And, the income protection for people in that category, I think absolutely should be there. I don't have any clients that fit that demographic. And I do have clients that fit every other demographic, including right up to the 80-year-olds. So, I think you probably get some of it as the industry transitions and you get newer advisors coming in as well.
Lawrence Heyman, I'd like to challenge a point, I guess.
Oh, good.
You said in your presentation that you feel that advisors reduce the cost to the budget, I guess in terms of social security cost. From what I hear with financial planning, a lot of retirees just want to get some pension so they can get the concessional benefits. And in your examples, you go through getting the co-contribution using the transition to retirement provisions. So I was wondering, wouldn't the cost to the budget, which what financial planners are suggesting is get the best out of what the government's offering, wouldn't you be a negative cost to the budget then?
At the very moment, I'm helping a client who is a mother of one of my other clients get the age pension. So she hadn't gone through the process, didn't realise she now qualified for it, and so I'm going through that process. So yeah, in that case, yes, that's an additional drain. I think there's two conflicting points. One is advisors are helping people use the system more effectively, and that could potentially add up to more cost to the government. The other side of the equation is that if people see an advisor early enough, then they might build up enough self-funding in retirement that they don't need to access the age pension. So that's the argument about reducing the reliance on the age pension. There are trade-offs. As I said, I haven't done any numbers around it, and it would be interesting to see whether one outweighed the other.
Thanks. Mike Murphy, following on from a question, the one before that one, with your pie charts, you don't need to put them back up again, but the move from commission to fees would seem to be a very positive move to be able to extend the financial benefits down, in that the mortgage for the young people with their mortgage and debt advice and some insurance needs is something where a move to fee advice would seem to be a catalyst for financial practices and planners to try and actually expand their spectrum of clients, and the fee-for-service option, even at the under-30s, they are so time-poor or whatever that they might actually pay a fee for something which they can see is value to them in credit card management or debt management or something anyway.
Well, I agree. I think that's right. I also think that there's a... A baby boomer light or a Gen Xer, I think there is a... there's a general cynicism in Gen X and Gen Y that fees get around... If you charge a fee, you get around that cynicism. So at the moment, they're cynics around the value or how advice would be paid for, and they don't want to pay commission. I think if you can go with a fee proposal, they're much more likely to accept it, and yeah, that lets you push down into those age bands. So I agree.
Oh, Andrew, Nick Florenzos. Not long ago, financial planners were the ones who provided investment and super advice, and advisors, mainly the insurance advice. It's pleasing to see that you've incorporated both types of advice in your slides and paper. Is that a genuine move now that more holistic advice is provided to clients, which includes the insurance side?
I mean, in terms of licensing, there's no distinction about whether you focus on the insurance market or the investment market. You need to get the authority from your licensee to be able to do both. But you know, effectively, once you've got that, there's not much distinction. There's still a group of advisors that focus on particular sides. I think there's probably a recognition that wherever you fit, you need to be able to have a solution for clients. So if you're primarily focused on the investment side of the equation, so investments and super, then you need to be able to refer people to an insurance specialist, and there are a lot of insurance specialists out there, and vice versa. I operate a holistic practice, so I do it all, and I think there is probably an increasing number of people in that category. And something like the GFC actually... Probably opens a lot of advisors who are focusing on the investment side, it probably opens their eyes to insurance as a potential revenue stream. So I think over time you'll see more of that. But you'll also get pockets of specialisation. You might get an insurance specialist working with an investment specialist. So the different models suit different practices.
Andrew, I think the most important thing I've learned out of today's session is that we shouldn't let you run the actuarial exams, because we got most of us failed question one and nobody managed to make it past question two. But thank you. It has been a very informative session. I think we have learnt a lot about what there is to know about financial advice, and you've certainly provided a good argument of the pros and cons of financial advice. So I would like to thank you. If anyone can just thank you.